Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Attorney General John Ashcroft has not been shy about praising his Justice Department's war on terror. Now, critics are saying his results have not matched his rhetoric and that civil liberties have been given the heave-ho. Tonight on Point, John Ashcroft's war on terror, arrests, convictions, and the bottom line on the Justice Department's work since 9/11. First tonight, we begin in Washington, where the Supreme Court began its new term today. In an unusual move on opening day, the court heard 2 hours of argument on sentencing guidelines that allow judges to boost sentences based on their own fact-finding rather than that determined by a jury. And that was just the top of the high court's agenda. David Savage is Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was at the court today. David Savage, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's the urgency that the court feels in diving into this sentencing argument?
Well, they've created something of a mess in the federal system because in June, near the end of the last term, the court handed down a ruling in a Washington state case that basically said any time a judge cannot on his own find some fact that increases the prison term, that has to be found by the jury. This sort of right to the jury trial includes the notion that the jury basically decides what crime you're really guilty of. Now, that seems like a simple statement, but it really threw a wrench in the federal system because the federal sentencing guidelines basically say to judges that you, the judge, should do that. The common situation is, suppose somebody gets convicted of a drug crime or a fraud. Sometimes those people plead guilty. Sometimes the jury convicts them. But then the sentence is what all the other evidence comes in. You know, somebody has been arrested and made one drug sale, which might get them 2 or 3 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutors come in and say, well, actually, this guy's a big-time drug dealer, and we found X amount of drugs in his car, and we found drugs in his house, and we have evidence to believe that he's really the leader of this gang, and you, judge, ought to give him something like 16 years in prison. So the objection is that if you're going to charge somebody with being, say, a big-time drug dealer who sold lots of drugs, that you ought to be forced to present that evidence to the jury.
Not just to the judge. And
not
of course,
just to the judge, right.
Of course, with that ruling earlier this summer, a lot was thrown into limbo here, which I guess explains why the court was so eager to jump on this today. They'll have to work that out one way or another in the course of this term. What else is high on their agenda this term, David?
Well, next week they're hearing a case about the death penalty for juvenile murderers. Under the current law, some states still can impose a death sentence on teenagers who are 16 or 17 when they commit the crime. The Supreme Court's being asked to declare that unconstitutional and basically say you can't impose a death sentence on anybody who's under 18. So that'll be a fairly big case.
Also, of course, everyone's eye on the court's age this year and how long this court has been there without any retirement, more than 10 years since a justice retired. This will be their 11th term together. I guess that's the longest stretch since 1812 to 1823, and with Chief Justice William Rehnquist turning 80 last Friday, this is not a young court. What's the scuttlebutt around the court about retirements in this next presidential term?
Well, I've sort of joked with my colleagues in the press room, you know, every 4 years we write the story saying that the next election is going to have a profound impact on the Supreme Court, and sooner or later, one of these years we're going to be right, and I would guess this is the year we're going to be right. As you said, Chief Justice Rehnquist just turned 80. He's sharp mentally, but he's looking older and frail, and I think there's a very good likelihood he will step down in the next 4 years. Justice John Paul Stevens is 84 and is the most remarkable 84-year-old I've ever seen. He's very energetic, very lively. A lot of people will say, based on his age, he's going to step down in the next 4 years. That may be so. I wouldn't bet everything on that. I think it's possible he may be there when he's 88 or 89. There's quite a few who are in their late 60s or early 70s, they seem to be have remarkable health and good spirits, and the job seems to keep them going. But when you have that many people who are that up there in age, you know, there's also just a possibility somebody could get sick and die, or sick and decide to step down. So
sooner or later things happen, and the odds of your being right on calling this an important election for the court only grow.
That's right. I'm sure sooner or later, as I say, we're going to be right about that.
And David, let me ask you finally, we're talking tonight about the Justice Department's war on terror. There's been a lot of interaction between the court and John Ashcroft's staff, sometimes supporting, sometimes attacking. Where do civil liberties and the war on terror show up in this term's docket, or do they?
Actually, they don't. We haven't had a real good civil liberties case growing out of the war on terror yet, with the exception of the various enemy combatant cases last spring.
Right.
I think the Justice Department sort of overreached and tried to sell the court on the idea that you can hold people indefinitely without a hearing at the say-so of the commander-in-chief. The court didn't buy that, but we haven't had any sort of search and seizure type cases or anything like that coming out of the war on terror. I assume they're coming, but there's not one before the court yet.
So what they've done so far may be what they stand with in this term. David Savage, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Good to do it, Tom.
David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about John Ashcroft's record in the war on terror. More than 3 years after September 11th, the Justice Department has detained over 5,000 suspected terrorists, leading to over 300 criminal indictments, more than 100 convictions, and 500-plus deportation orders. But the convictions, Georgetown law professor David Cole tells us, are not for terrorism, but for minor charges. And all of the 500 deported men and women were cleared of any connection to terrorism before being shipped out. So far, says Cole, John Ashcroft is batting zero for 5,000. Tonight on Point, John Ashcroft's war on terror, arrests, convictions, and the bottom line on the Justice Department's work since 9/11. Have you followed the public pronouncements of the Attorney General? Do the actual results back up those public proclamations? Is this rough but necessary justice being done, or abuse of rights without results? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Cole, law professor at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, David Cole.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for being with us. So, step back for a second, look at this Justice Department and its work in these last 3 years, and give us your top-level assessment of how it's done, David Cole.
Well, as your intro suggested, I don't think it's done very well, particularly in the use of the coercive arm of the law, that is locking people up, charging people under immigration and criminal law provisions, and seeking to either detain them or deport them. This has been a central part of their campaign really since the beginning. In October of 2001, John Ashcroft made a speech in New York where he compared himself favorably to Robert Kennedy. He's the only one who has thus far made that favorable comparison. But he said, you know, just like Bobby Kennedy would arrest a mobster for spitting on the sidewalk, so too I, John Ashcroft, will use every law within my power, including immigration law, to lock up suspected terrorists, keep them off the streets, and prevent the next terrorist attack from occurring. And ever since, the mantra from the Justice Department has been that this is a preventive paradigm. And it's understandable. You it's not enough to catch a suicide bomber after he's committed suicide and killed many other people. We do want to prevent the next terrorist attack from occurring, but John Ashcroft has not figured out how to predict the future. And so in adopting a preventive paradigm, he has swept broadly, used laws that are not focused on terrorism, rounded up lots of people who have nothing to do with terrorism, claimed that rounding up in and of itself was some sign of success. But when you look at the results, 3 years down the road, he is, as you suggested, 0 for 5,000. And what that 0 for 5,000 means is, of the 5,000 foreign nationals who've been subjected to preventive detention in anti-terrorism measures, Not a single one stands convicted of any terrorist crime.
And that's the zero for 5,000 you're describing. But then take us on through those numbers, David Cole. You describe the 300 indictments, the 100 convictions. Why is that not proof in the pudding?
Right. Well, those are not from the preventive detention cases specifically. If you go to their website, they will say, in terrorism investigations, we have netted over 300, I think it might be 380 or something now, indictments, over 100 and some convictions, and over 500 deportations. But when you look at those convictions, they're not convictions for terrorist crimes. Indeed, there was a study done by a Syracuse University Institute last year that took the Justice Department's own figures and looked at all the cases that the Justice Department identified as terrorism cases,
mm-hmm.
and it found that and looked at all the convictions, and it found that the median sentence imposed in all the convictions they had obtained in terrorism cases identified by the Justice Department as terrorism, the median sentence was 14 days. 14 days. Now, you don't get a 14-day sentence in the United States for being found guilty of terrorism. You get a 100-year sentence or a 25-year sentence or a 50-year sentence if you're found guilty of engaging in terrorism.
So what kind of convictions were these?
These are convictions for minor credit card fraud, largely fraud. The vast majority of them are fraud cases. So they're people that the government came across for one reason or another. They searched for something that they could charge them with, and they charged them with it, whether or not they had anything to do with terrorism. And ultimately, if they charge them with a credit card fraud, then you can be pretty sure that the person's not a terrorist, because charging someone with credit card abuse is not going to stop them from engaging in terrorism. What it's going to do is, at most, it's going to get them, a several-month, maybe a year sentence, and then they're going to be out. And if they are committed terrorists, they can continue to engage in terrorist activity against us. So,
and what about the 500 deportations? Is that clearing the land of terror threats, David?
Well, that isn't either. Again, they suggest that on their website. We've deported 515 people, but what they don't say is that they had a policy, which is called hold until cleared, which said we won't deport somebody until we clear him of any connection to terrorism. So someone is, and the Inspector General did a study of the particularly of the sweeps right after September 11th, and he found that of the hundreds and hundreds of people that were picked up then, often on such evidence as there are too many Middle Eastern men working in a convenience store down the street. That's the tip the FBI gets. So they go down and arrest the Middle Eastern men working in a convenience store down the street. There is nothing to link them to terrorism, but they're presumed to be terrorism suspects because they're Arab. Because we can't rule out the fact that they're not a terrorist simply by looking at their name, so we presume they're a terrorist, lock them up, look for something to charge them with. Then, once we determine that they are not convicted, not involved with terrorism, have no connections to terrorism, then if they're an immigrant and they have a visa violation, and only then can they be deported. So many of these people who were locked up initially admitted that they had violated the immigration law and said, "I'll leave the country." Which, in an ordinary course of business, would be the end of the case, because that's the purpose of an immigration hearing. But
right.
Here, they were seeking to hold them, and so when they said they'd leave the country, that became a problem. So they adopted this hold until cleared policy, where they kept people locked up even after their immigration cases were resolved, and there was no legitimate justification for them to lock them up until they could clear them of any connection to terrorism. Ultimately, they were all cleared of any connection to terrorism.
100%.
Yeah, and some were released back into the population, those that didn't have an immigration problem, and some were deported, those that did.
You're very critical of this. There's another perspective that says, well, this is what terrorism prevention is like. You have to be very active and not count on every detainee being the terrorist, but this is the way to kind of tighten the net.
Well, I understand that argument, but when you look at the results and you look at 0 for 5,000, it doesn't suggest that this is a very useful tactic. And this is not the first time that we've engaged in what John Ashcroft calls a preventive paradigm and rounded up lots of people. In in the Palmer raids in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombings.
David Cole, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Attorney General John Ashcroft's War on Terror. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Attorney General John Ashcroft's War on Terror, about arrests, convictions, and the bottom line in the Justice Department's work since 9/11. My guest tonight has been David Cole. He joins us from Washington, D.C. He's a law professor at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it fair to describe John Ashcroft's work as 5,000 arrests and zero terrorism convictions? Is that missing a benefit in detentions and deportations themselves? Or is the Justice Department abusing rights and not getting results? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Cole, you were going all the way back to the Palmer raids in the early 20th century to make a comparison.
Right, just to make the point that we've adopted these kind of preventive detention campaigns in the past. After a series of terrorist bombings hit the United States in 1919, the Justice Department went out and rounded up about 5,000 foreign nationals, ironically 5,000, and at the end of the day, not one of them was charged or convicted with any involvement in the bombings. During World War II, we were concerned about espionage and sabotage, and we, of course, locked up 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry out of concern that some of them might be engaged in espionage and sabotage, and not one was turned out to have engaged in espionage and sabotage. So these kinds of really extremely broad-brush measures have not worked in the past, have never worked before. And one of the things that they really do, that we know they do, is they alienate the communities that are targeted. And so what they have done is to alienate the Arab and Muslim communities in the United States, but not only in the United States, around the world, because these detentions and these abuses targeted at foreign nationals get a lot more press in other countries, the countries from which these people come, than in our country. And they have contributed in a very profound way to the unprecedented level of anti-Americanism that we now see around the world. And that makes it more difficult for us to get the cooperation we need to find the real terrorists, and it makes it more likely that al-Qaeda will find willing recruits to its side of the battle. So I think in the long run, not only have they not shown us positive results, but I think there are very, very serious negative consequences that have come. Now, I just want to say one caveat. I'm not suggesting that there have been no terrorist convictions since September 11, 2001. The Justice Department has obtained a handful of convictions against the young men in Lackawanna who went to an al-Qaeda training camp, against some men in Virginia who were playing paintball in preparation for going over to India and fighting over there, some guys in Portland who were trying to go to Afghanistan to fight against the United States. So they've had a handful of convictions here and there, but those are not of people who were subjected to preventive detention, that is, locked up and then look around for something to charge them with. Those are all people who went through the ordinary course of the criminal process, where they were investigated, they were charged with having engaged in a terrorist crime, and then they were locked up and tried, not the other way around.
So you're looking at preventative detention, which has been a big part of what's gone on, and saying big numbers, but no beef here. And maybe, you're saying, and certainly some downside in looking away from U.S. legal principles and in alienation of populations in the U.S. and abroad. I want to get another perspective on this. David Cole, if you'll stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation, also from Washington, Richard Samp. He is chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation. It's a conservative-leaning law firm and think tank in Washington. Richard Samp, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
It's good to have you. David Cole looks at the numbers around preventive detention, looks at the outcome from those 5,000 plus, and says this is a lot of borderline treatment of people in the United States and very little to show for it. Gives it a pretty poor, failing grade, Richard Samp. How do you look at it?
Well, if you're going to look at the Justice Department report card, I think what you really need to look at is how many major terrorist incidents there have been in this country since September 11th. And if you look at it that way, I think the record has been pretty good. Now, I suspect that the Justice Department doesn't want to boast along those lines because it's always afraid that the day after it makes its big announcement that we've kept the country terror-free for the last 3 years, that there will be another major attack, and that's something that they always need to be on guard for. However, given that we have been told by al-Qaeda leaders around the world for the last couple of years that they're planning to attack any time, the fact that we haven't had attacks is, to me, one very good sign that the Justice Department is doing its job.
So no attacks. We'll put that aside as Exhibit A for a second and come back to that with David Cole. Let's look at the preventive detentions, the 5,000, maybe 5,000 plus. How do you see those, given that there have not been terrorist convictions coming out of those? Is it still a worthwhile exercise? Is it an exercise in tune with American legal principles? Is it ultimately beneficial?
Well, first of all, I don't think the comparison to the Palmer raids is a good one because I don't know of anybody who has been arrested and detained based solely on the fact that someone says there are too many Arabs around. Instead, in every case that I'm aware of, somebody was guilty of at least an immigration violation. And
but that's very different from being a terrorist. I mean, there are many immigration violators that aren't rounded up.
That's correct. And I think perhaps we need to do more in law enforcement. But I think people who are at least suspected of possible involvement with terrorism are a good place to start. And to say that we're batting 0 for 500 among those who are deported, I'd say we're batting 500 for 500 because they are not in the country. And whether or not there was a sufficient proof to bring criminal charges against these people, there was nonetheless proof that they were violators of the immigration law, and that there's also a pretty good bet that they're not going to be in this country in the future.
But how can you say 500 for 500 when, as David Cole describes it anyway, the Justice Department had this hold until cleared policy, so they would not be deporting people who had terror links?
They would not be deporting people who they were able to bring some sort of criminal charges against. That's correct. But I do think that it's fair to remember, for example, that a number of the 9/11 hijackers were here illegally on visas that they had overstayed. And had we had that kind of program then, it is very possible that some of them might have been arrested and sent out of the country before they could have been involved at that point.
And that's the 500 deportees, the 5,000 detainees. Would you put the same sort of standard to them that the country is better off because they were detained, even though they weren't charged with terror-related crimes?
Most of them were charged with some offense of some sort or another. Now, when you say that a crime is not terror-related simply because all they did were the kinds of things that terrorists might do, like, for example, establishing false identification papers by fraudulently obtaining documents, it doesn't bother me that those kind of people were arrested and convicted, even if they were not major offenses, because after all, once they're convicted, the day they get out of jail, the first thing that happens is they get deported.
David Cole, here's the response. Richard Sam says, number one, no attacks, so someone's doing something right, and who's to say it's not John Ashcroft? And then, he says, the country is better off without those 500 deportees and better off having seen the 5,000 detained.
Well, to take the first one first, thankfully there hasn't been a terrorist incident here within the last 3 years, but I think given the results the Justice Department can show, they can't really credibly take very much credit for that. I mean, compare what they have to show, 0 for 5,000, the only thing even approaching an al-Qaeda terror cell that they've been able to identify are these hapless young men in Lackawanna who, yes, went to an al-Qaeda training camp, but never took any action whatsoever indicating any interest in engaging in any illegal activity once they returned. Were under surveillance for a very long time, never took any action whatsoever. That's the best they can show. Compare that to the Army. Compare that to the Army in terms of taking credit for the fact there hasn't been a terrorist attack. They went over to Afghanistan. They knocked out the al-Qaeda training camps. They knocked out the Taliban, al-Qaeda's supporters. They knocked out the headquarters of al-Qaeda. They captured, they say, approximately three-quarters of al-Qaeda's leaders. They got information in those raids, including laptop computers, that led them to many of these people. But notably, these people have all these three-quarters of al-Qaeda's leaders, have all been captured abroad, not by John Ashcroft through these domestic initiatives, looking at, you know, routine immigration violators, but at, you know, actual intelligence, actionable intelligence gained through the military campaign against al-Qaeda. So I just don't think that the domestic campaign can really take very much credit. When, you know, when you look at it, the only actual terrorist incident that they have "quote unquote" brought to justice, or you know, in through the criminal law process, is Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and that
right.
wasn't through anything that John Ashcroft did, but simply because there was an alert stewardess who saw this strange-looking guy trying to light his shoe. So,
but I want to understand what you're saying here, David Cole. Are you saying then that you suspect there's a lot of terror planning going on, and the Justice Department is missing it, or that they've come up with a big volume, but they're misrepresenting what that volume means?
I don't have – well, they're certainly misrepresenting what the volume means, and they haven't come up with much of a volume. I mean, when you look at the what they claim as their victories, for the most part, they're not victories. They're minor charges against people that have led to minor sentences that do nothing to stop terrorism. They're deportations in which people have been determined not to be involved with terrorism, and so those aren't terrorists. And you know, the last thing you'd want to do if someone was actually a terrorist would be to deport him to some other country where he can continue to engage in his planning against you and against your targets here and overseas without your being able to conduct surveillance and keep track of what he's doing. So, you know, it'd be crazy to use the immigration process for this purpose. And, you know, Richard says, well, you know, if we deport 500, that's fine. There's 2 million people living here illegally. 2 million, almost all of them have committed some form of fraud simply by being here illegally. In order to live here illegally, you have to engage in some sort of fraud. So we could basically focus on any group, any ethnic group in the country, and you would be able to come up with 500 deportations like that.
David Cole, stand by. Richard Simp, I'm sure you want to respond there, but I want to bring our callers in first, if you'll be so kind. Richard is calling from New York City. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to respond to David Cole. I was downtown Manhattan on 9/11, I saw the people jumping out of the buildings. And David Cole is really being very disingenuous on the way that he's speaking about this. There, the 9/11 killers had a lot of support in the United States. They stayed at safe houses. They had they spoke with and communicated with many people throughout the country. And what happened was that these people were supported and aided. Now, they may not have been something that they that could have been was a crime, but they picked up through people's laptops, through their telephones, their call records, the interactions. And so what I'm saying is that I wouldn't want David Cole protecting me. You know, it's funny, his name is Cole, and they did bomb the Cole, al-Qaeda.
But Richard, let me ask you, are you saying that you believe that among the 5,000 detainees and the 500 deportees that the Ashcroft Justice Department has acted on, that you think this supporters, as you describe them, have been found out and dealt with?
Well, certainly I'm not privy to every one of the 5,000 that were held, but the point is prudence means that we do check them out. And I wouldn't want David Cole determining that. You know, he keeps on saying John Ashcroft. He seems to have a vindictive nature, and I guess it's political. But basically what it is that I'd rather that our families are protected, people who are breaking the law, whether it be immigration laws, but they're breaking the law, and if the Justice Department deems that they need to pick them up to investigate them, that their names were found on computers, their names were found through telephone records, they were found in people's telephone books, their address books,
yeah.
Terrorists, that David Cole would have us hold up our hands, and every one of us would be a victim. And I'll tell you, David, in your lifetime, we'll be fighting this, even though you wish to let us surrender to these terrorists, so all of our children will be incinerated.
Richard, we've got it, and we hear what you saw on 9/11, and we feel your response to that, and thank you very much for your call. Richard Simp, let me go first to you with that. Our caller suggests there were computers picked up and names found, and the suggestion is, or the desire anyway, is to believe that those are the names, those are the people who were detained and or deported. Is that a fair assessment?
Everybody who was picked up for a reason. Now, Mr. Cole, I guess, thinks that it's a bad idea to focus on Middle Eastern men because that is somehow racial profiling, when in fact everybody is quite aware that most of the people who are going to be potential suspects in the war being waged on us by militant Islamic men are mostly militant Islamic men. So I see nothing wrong with the government doing that. Also, just to respond briefly to his point about Richard Reed, I think he's a little bit late on that argument because just today the Justice Department announced the indictment of Sajid Badat, who was allegedly Mr. Reed's co-conspirator in the shoe bombing case, and he went to Afghanistan to get shoe bombs. So the Justice Department is on that case.
And David Cole, you hear the New York caller not liking the tone of your criticism here, saying he doesn't feel safe if you're in charge.
Right. Well, he doesn't have to worry. I'm not in charge. But let me say this. I want no less than anybody else to not see another atrocity like we saw on September 11th. That is the last thing any of us wants to see. The question is this Justice Department going about it in a way that will, in fact, make us safer? And the argument I'm making is not only that they're acting in ways that raise some serious civil liberties concerns, but that they are acting in ways that do not make us safer. Zero for 5,000 does not make us safer, and it makes us less safe by creating the kind of alienation and enmity that I talked about before. And I'm not the only one who has said this. The 9/11 Commission issued a staff report in which they found that these immigration measures, much vaunted by John Ashcroft and the Justice Department, had shown absolutely no results in terms of making us safer. Richard Clark, who was ahead of our counterterrorism policy until quite recently, has been very critical of precisely the fact that the Justice Department did not do enough to go out and track down the people who may have been supporting the 19 hijackers, and instead use this very broad, sweeping approach in which they pick people up. Richard said, well, they must have been picked up for a reason, but as the inspector general who looked into this campaign found, people were picked up for such reasons as an anonymous tip that there are too many Middle Eastern men working at a convenience store down the street. That's it. If you're picking people up because there's too many Middle Eastern men working in a convenience store, you're not going to find the terrorists.
Richard Samp, let me ask you, we're coming up to a break. Are you being too forgiving here? Even if you're in favor of aggressively going after potential terror suspects, is there still another element of judgment that needs to go on here that you're being too forgiving of in the Justice Department's work?
Well, I do think that many of the investigations that have gone afterwards have shown shortcomings in government efforts, and I'm not here to whitewash those. In particular, I think that the Inspector General at the Justice Department has shown that some of the people who were detained were needlessly abused, and that sort of behavior is totally unwarranted. Nonetheless, the overall policy of the government is one that we ought to be applauding, and if we spend our time picking nits of everything that the department does, we are opening ourselves to further attacks.
Well, here we are, nitpicking or a real big issue. We're looking at John Ashcroft's War on Terror tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David Cole, Richard Samp, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Attorney General John Ashcroft's War on Terror. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see a fundamental disregard of the principles of U.S. law in Ashcroft's handiwork? Can that be justified by the margin of extra safety that might have been gained here? Or is it high-handed injustice that itself could breed more terror? Where are your sympathies here? And what grade do you give the Ashcroft counter-terror effort? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with David Cole, law professor at Georgetown University, author of Enemy Aliens. Also from Washington, Richard Samp, chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation. It's a conservative-leaning law firm and think tank in Washington. We're joined right now from Alexandria, Virginia, by Frank Dunham, Jr. He is a federal public defender. He is lawyer for Yasser E. Hamdi, an American citizen captured in Afghanistan in late 2001. In June, the Supreme Court ruled that Hamdi and enemy combatants like him, he had been at Guantanamo, had to be given a chance to challenge their detention, contrary to the Bush administration's position. Rather than give him that hearing, the administration decided to negotiate the terms of his release. Frank Dunham, thanks for joining us tonight.
Okay, I'm happy to be here.
So it has been arranged that your client Yasser Hamdi will be shipped back to Saudi Arabia. He will give up his U.S. citizenship, and this is in return for his freedom.
Well, that's in return for his return to his home country and his family.
And what's the lesson that you've drawn at the end of all this, Frank Dunham, from Yasser Hamdi's detention?
That the government often gets all wrapped around the axle of their own arguments about national security without, you know, really taking a realistic view of what's at stake, and that they will take extreme positions with regard to the Constitution and our rights to protect dubious or no threat to our security.
Yasser Hamdi was picked up in Afghanistan. The circumstances didn't look good. He went to Guantanamo and then was in a naval brig in South Carolina, incommunicado for over 2 years. Can you understand why the government did that in the first place?
Well, you know, in the fog of war, you're on a battlefield or under hostile circumstances like we were facing in Afghanistan. It's easy to understand how somebody could be detained by U.S. forces under circumstances where prudence dictates holding the person over letting him go. But it would seem like you could sort the thing out more quickly than they did in Mr. Hamdi's case. But the problem is when you get into litigation, things take on a life of their own. And even though I believe the uniformed forces would have much earlier in the day concluded that Mr. Hamdi was entitled to his release, the litigation had momentum, and nobody could really face up to what the reality of the situation was. And we end up going all the way to the Supreme Court with constitutional issues on the line that perhaps never needed to be there, that shouldn't have been there if, practical look at the situation had been taken early on.
And, of course, Yasser Hamdi, born in Louisiana, which gave him his U.S. citizenship, grew up in Saudi Arabia. He'll be back there soon. Back to what circumstances? Will he be a free citizen?
He'll be living his life like he always intended to live it. As a young Saudi man, living near his brothers and his father and mother and his sisters-in-law and going back to college and doing what he always thought he would do with his life.
And maybe not heading back to Afghanistan anytime soon. Frank Dunham, Jr., thanks very much for being with us tonight.
No problem.
Frank Dunham represents Yasser Hamdi. He's a federal public defender. David Cole, what do you hear in that story of Yasser Hamdi? Went all the way to the Supreme Court. He's soon on his way to Saudi Arabia, effectively stripped of his U.S. citizenship in the process, but gone out.
Gone out. And again, you know, if this was somebody who, before the Supreme Court, the government claimed was so dangerous that not only did he need to be locked up incommunicado without access to the courts, but he couldn't even talk to a lawyer. He couldn't even be informed that his case was before the Supreme Court. His case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he never even knew that a case had been filed because he was kept incommunicado, denied access to any contact with the outside world. And the claim in the Supreme Court was, this guy is so dangerous that we've got to use these extraordinary measures against him, and we have the final say on that. The courts have basically only a rubber stamp role to play in reviewing the president's determination that this guy is, as President Bush put it, a bad guy and therefore should be locked up. And I think that's an indication, it's a reflection of the kind of positions that the government has unfortunately taken. It has taken the position that we can throw out the rule of law, throw out checks and balances, throw out due process in the name of national security. And when you really sort of look under the surface, it turns out that those claims are very much exaggerated. I mean, if this person actually posed a threat to national security, he wouldn't be released now. The Supreme Court didn't order his release. All the Supreme Court ordered was that he be given a hearing at which he be given a fair opportunity to contest whether or not he was fighting for the Taliban. That's all. And they just turned around and let him go, which suggests that they didn't really need to keep him as long as they did in the first place.
Richard Samp, what do you take away from the Yasser Hamdi story?
Well, first of all, I would say that the government won more than it's lost before the U.S. Supreme Court.
This is but with the Supreme Court saying they couldn't hold so-called enemy combatants.
No, I think what they said was exactly the opposite, that the government can hold enemy combatants, that they do not need to bring them to trial. What they do need to do is to give them a fair opportunity to contest administratively the government's determination that they are an enemy combatant.
So, I mean, they couldn't hold them indefinitely incommunicado, as Hamdi effectively was.
Well, Hamdi had access to his to an attorney at a point later than I thought was appropriate, mm-hmm. but well before he got before the Supreme Court. What Hamdi was claiming and what Mr. Dunham was claiming on his behalf was that you don't even have the right to hold an American citizen at all. And the Supreme Court said no. It has always been the tradition in war that when you capture enemy soldiers, you can detain them for the duration of the fighting. The fighting is still going on in Afghanistan. The government had every good reason to hold him until they could get assurances that he would not be returning to Afghanistan to fight again.
But not now, incommunicado, the Supreme Court says. So there's a, I don't know, that people claim victory on both sides there. But what about Hamdi's case itself? Is it an example of an effective detention or a mistaken detention?
I think it was very important to detain Taliban fighters until such time as assurances could be obtained that they would not be returning to the fight, which continues. Mr. Hamdi, in return for his release, has promised not to leave Saudi Arabia and certainly not to return to Afghanistan. And once you have that assurance, he clearly is not as dangerous as people like Jose Padilla, who came to this country intent on blowing up apartment buildings and setting off a dirty bomb. So it doesn't bother me particularly that he has been released after 2 years.
But if he was a real terror threat, do you think the government would have let him go if they thought he was...
No, I don't believe they would have, and that's because he never was a terror threat. He was an enemy soldier. He was just simply one of many Arab men who decided to go to Afghanistan to fight on behalf of the Taliban, was probably mistaken in doing so. Hopefully he has learned his lesson and he's not going to go to Afghanistan again, but I don't see him as being anything more than just an enemy soldier who was... caught up in fighting.
David Cole, a new term coming up could be for President Bush. If it is, what do you expect? More of the same from the Justice Department, or are we into a new era now?
Well, definitely more of the same. But let me just go back for 1 second to Hamdi. The notion that the government won more than it lost in Hamdi is really crazy. The only justice on this court, and this is a conservative court. Remember, this is the court that put President Bush in office.
Mm-hmm.
The only justice who adopted the administration's view was Justice Thomas. 8-1 they lost on the basic issue in the case, which was whether there was meaningful review of the decision to detain. But putting that aside, what can we expect in the future? We can expect, I think, not just more of the same, but worse. Because there will be another terrorist attack, and everybody recognizes that who's in government, that you can't possibly stop every terrorist attack. There will be another attack, and once there's another attack, there will be voices saying, we didn't go far enough the last time, and this is not an administration that has shown any sensitivity to the civil liberties side of the balance. And it is a balance, and I don't think it's, you know, civil liberties overall. I think you have to strike a balance, and I think if we are... show that we are in a more vulnerable position. We may need to sacrifice certain aspects of our liberties if, in fact, they will make us safer. But what we've seen to date, I think, is an administration that takes sort of blunderbuss approaches, that tries to throw aside the rule of law, claim that in the name of executive war-making power, all bets are off, including we can torture people if the president says it's important in exercising the war power. That's not the kind of administration that I'd like to be under for the next 4 years.
With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Richard Samp at the Washington Legal Foundation, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And David Cole, law professor at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, new security measures at U.S. airports target travelers from some of America's oldest allies. This is On Point. In an effort to tighten security against terrorism, the United States last week began fingerprinting and photographing even visitors from the nation's longtime allies. The Homeland Security Department says the new requirements will affect 33,000 visitors a day, and that the process only takes about 15 seconds. The measures were already in place for most nations. On Thursday, they were expanded to the 27 countries whose citizens don't need visas for 90-day visits to the United States. These include the United Kingdom, Japan, Ireland, Australia, and more. Over the weekend, On Point visited Logan Airport in Boston to see how incoming passengers were reacting to the tight new security measures.
I heard about the fingerprinting on the BBC yesterday morning, and I did mention it to the family. You know, we're all going to be fingerprinted and pictures taken. So it was not bad at all. I don't mind doing it. If it makes life safer, then it's brilliant. Because I wouldn't mind it being done in England. To tell you the truth, I think it'd be a good idea if it was done all over the world. It'd make all the airports a lot safer, the countries a lot safer, so I think it's a jolly good idea.
Feels weird. It really does, because, I don't know, I mean, I can't understand when they do that to, well, people that they think that might be terrorists, but I mean, me as just a regular student, I'm 25 and have never done anything bad, and still they do it. But I understand it, and like looking at the whole security aspect, so it's okay. I mean, if they want it, then I do it. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, even though I think it's kind of weird because I don't know what they're gonna do with my fingerprints. I mean, unless I do something bad, they're not gonna be of any use, so it's okay.
Well, I've never flown to the US before, but I was aware from the papers in Ireland that it was about to happen. So we just filled in the immigration forms, which was new to me. And then once you presented your immigration form, the guy just went through your passport, and it's a very, very simple process, really. You know, both index fingers, picture, and it took about 15 seconds. I mean, like, I'm not going to get uptight things sinister, so I'm not too bothered, really, you know. I mean, like, you know, we're on file in various places, you know, so it doesn't really bother me.
You just queue as you used to do before, and then it's just that you not only show your passport, and I not only ask the reason why you want to stay there for a certain time, and at the end you just have to dip in your left finger in a soft cloth, and then you have to put it on this kind of red plate or whatever, it's of glass, and you have to do the same with the right finger, and then you have to look into the camera so that they take a picture of you, probably, and that's about it. And when you want to enter the country and you have done nothing wrong, then you will do this, I think. I'm probably too tired to be nervous.
I thought it rather strange that we, being allies in the US, that we have to go through that, and I'm worried about what they're going to do with that information. It could be misled that I'd be something which I aren't, or I may take some time before I can clear customs. It might be okay. It might be okay, but I'm not quite sure. You know, don't know where it's going. Don't know who's going to use it. Is it going to be contained within the Americans' governmental system, or is it going to be spread across the world? But in the days of global technology, one's information is transferred across the world in milliseconds, you know.
How do I put it? Scary, really, you know. Makes you feel like a criminal, but you're not. You're in your own country and you're getting fingerprints. I suppose it has to be done now these days, doesn't it?
There it is. Ruth Horn of England, Anne Buda of Germany, John Harnett of Ireland, Karen Thompson of Germany, Ronnie Crooks of Northern Ireland, and Robbie Cheevers of Ireland, all reacting to the new security measure, which now requires visitors from even close allies of the U.S. to be fingerprinted and photographed before entering the country. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.